This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
I'm joined here with Keith Preston of Attack the System, and we're going to be talking about the war in Ukraine. Keith Preston, great having you back on the show.
Yeah, it's been a while. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's completely transforming geopolitics, this war, and talk of a new Cold War. Just kind of start things off to go over the narrative, because from like the non-aggression principle, Russia is the aggressor, and they blatantly violated international law. But then when you kind of look at things from a geopolitical standpoint, it gets more complex, like the unprovoked narrative, and where the blame is put, because when people see footage of atrocities that Russia is responsible for, then it kind of justifies one-sided narrative, where it does become taboo to discuss some of the background, like just stuff that issues that Tucker Carlson or people like Glenn Greenwald have touched upon, and also John Mearsheimer, and even Tulsi Gabbard. Like this narrative with the background of NATO and the causes of the conflict. And so Ukraine has gone back and forth between pro-Western and pro-Russian leadership. And one of the arguments was that Russia considered joining NATO to be a red line. And people bring up the comparisons that the United States would object, obviously, to having Mexico become under the Chinese sphere of influence. And then what John Mearsheimer brought up, but ideally there should have been some kind of agreed upon neutrality, but because of diplomacy was so damaged, that didn't happen, and things have escalated and become much worse. So Keith, do you want to just sort of comment on the geopolitical narrative and what led up to the war?
Yeah, okay. Well, obviously this goes back a long way in history, but to understand what's going on here, we have to understand the perspective of Russian foreign policy interest. Like, why is Ukraine so important to Russia? Historically, if we look at the history of Russia, we see that Russia has been invaded multiple times. And the invasion route from what is their west, our east, but through Eastern Europe, is directly through this corridor, through this Eastern European corridor. Of course, that's how Germany invaded Russia back in World War II. Russia was invaded from that route during the First World War. Napoleon invaded Russia way back in the early 19th century through that Eastern European corridor. So Russia views Eastern Europe as critical to their own defensive interests, and not just Eastern Europe, but the entirety of the territories that surround Russia. One thing about Russia geographically is that it has no natural defenses. Like, the United States has excellent natural defenses, about the best you could hope for. We have two huge oceans to the east and west, weak nations to the north and south, no other major powers in the hemisphere. That's about as good, and a continent-wide state, all right? That's about as good as it gets. But Russia doesn't have anything like that. They have a lot of territory. It's a large country. But it's also wide open as far as the surrounding areas. They have no natural defenses like mountains and things like that, oceans and any of that stuff. So Russian foreign policy, going all the way back to the era of the Tsars, long before the Soviet Union, has always been about maintaining as much territory as possible around Russia as a buffer zone between Russia and external powers. That's why Russia has always been so adamant about maintaining Eastern Europe, the Central Asian countries like Kazakhstan and places like that, the Caucasus countries like Georgia and Armenia. Russia's always considered that to be their rightful sphere of influence, and the reason why is that they want to use those areas as a buffer zone for themselves. Now, the counter-argument to that, of course, is, well, they also want to exploit those regions. The old Russian Empire dominated those territories as colonies and things like that, and all of that is true. But if you want to understand how the Russians perceive it, that's how they look at this. They look at it like that whole region, that whole Eurasian corridor is essential to their defensive interests, to their geopolitical interests. Now, as far as Eastern Europe, remember that at Yalta, at the end of World War II, Franklin Roosevelt and then Harry Truman, and then Winston Churchill and Stalin got together and basically carved up the world, and it was agreed that Eastern Europe would be Russia's domain of influence. And all throughout the Cold War, Russia maintained these puppet states in Eastern Europe that were essentially vassalages to Russia. There were seven of them. It was, I won't list them all, but they were the countries that formed the Warsaw Pact. That was why Russia was so adamant about holding on to those countries. Whenever there were attempted reforms or anti-Soviet rebellions in places like Poland, Hungary, what was then Czechoslovakia, you would have Russian tanks coming in to crush the rebellion, and a big part of that is because they viewed that area as essential to their own defensive interests, the Eastern European region. Now, when the Cold War was ending in the late 80s and early 90s, an agreement was made between Mikhail Gorbachev, who was then his title would have been the premier of the Soviet Union, and President George H.W. Bush, Sr. An agreement was made by those two administrations that following the Cold War, Germany would be allowed to reunite and become one Germany again, which it is today, and that Germany would be allowed to be in NATO, that a reunited Germany would be allowed to be in NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and that the area east of Germany, west of Russia, those areas would remain a type of neutral zone. You know, those would be independent countries. They wouldn't be Soviet vassalages, but they would be independent countries. They would not be brought into NATO. That was the agreement between the initial agreement between the Americans and Gorbachev. Well, after the Soviet Union collapsed and after new administrations came in, particularly the administration of Bill Clinton, there was a push to expand NATO further and further eastward. So eventually they started incorporating new countries into NATO, which were Hungary, Poland, Romania, the Baltic states. There are three of those. There may have been others. And also some of the former provinces of Yugoslavia as well. So a lot of these former Soviet satellite states in Eastern Europe and a lot of the former Yugoslav provinces were incorporated into NATO as well. So NATO expanded to the point where I think NATO has about 30 countries today. Now, the Russians see that as a security threat. The Russian argument is that the West is trying to push NATO right up to Russia's border, which they have.
So you would not agree with the narrative when media sources, the establishment says unprovoked?
Yeah, no, exactly. No, the Russians would say that is a provocation. The Russians would say extending NATO to states that border Russia, like, say, Latvia and Estonia and some of those, they would say that is a provocation. And to put it in context, imagine what would happen if the Russians tried to incorporate Mexico into a military alliance. Like, imagine if the Russians or the Chinese said, well, we are going to bring either Canada...
Yeah, isn't that basically the Bay of Pigs, which almost became a full-blown war?
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the prelude was sort of a... the Bay of Pigs was sort of a prelude to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yeah, but the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, what happened there is that the Russians were trying to put some missiles in Cuba, which was one of their allies, a client state. And, of course, the Americans weren't having that. Now, another thing that's often left out of that story is that the Americans had already placed missiles in Turkey, because Turkey is also a NATO member and was also an American client state at the time. And the Americans had actually placed missiles in Turkey aimed at the Russian heartland. So that wasn't one-sided either. And part of the backdoor agreement between John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev in the Cuban Missile Crisis is that both sides would remove their missiles, that the Russians would, or the Soviet Union would refrain from placing any missiles in Cuba, but then the Americans would withdraw their missiles from Turkey as well. Now, the Americans rescinded that in the early 80s, after Russia invaded Afghanistan in 1979, and then Ronald Reagan came into office in the 1980s. The Reagan administration rescinded that. They actually redeployed missiles to Turkey. So all of this is important to what we're talking about now, because that's the Russian perspective on this. The Russian perspective is, for the sake of their own security interests, they need a wide buffer zone around the Russian state itself, and then they cannot allow hostile interests to incorporate surrounding territories into a military alliance, which has happened with the Baltic states and some of these other
places. Did you see the speech by John Mearsheimer? I think this was actually a prediction before the actual invasion. He predicted this would happen, and he said that ideally Russia and the United States would have some kind of treaty to agree where Ukraine would be a neutral zone, but it would be heavily invested in economically. That would be the best case scenario. But the problem is that would take a lot of diplomacy. So are you familiar with John Mearsheimer's work, his prediction before the invasion, and then also how much do you think the Russiagate narrative under Trump contributed to this crisis as far as making diplomacy practically impossible?
Yeah, I'm familiar with Mearsheimer's work in this area, but it's not just Mearsheimer who made this argument. This is a fairly common argument that, you know, geopolitical analysts, you know, those that are looking at it with any kind of objectivity has made, that the idea of expanding NATO to the Russian border is a provocative act, or at least there's certainly going to be interpreted as one. And as you were saying, Ukraine is important to Russia because they do not want Ukraine to be incorporated into NATO. My suspicion is that the reason that the Russians made a move on Ukraine when they did is because they think, well, it needs to be done before Ukraine is actually incorporated into NATO, because they would certainly view that as a security threat. They would certainly view a Ukraine that is a member of NATO, which would in turn be an Article 5 country. For those who don't know what that means, in the NATO Charter, Article 5 of the NATO Charter binds every NATO member to come to the defense of any of the others if one is attacked. So that means if there's a war between Ukraine, if Ukraine were to have been an Article 5 country, which they're not, but if they had been, when Ukraine was attacked, that would mean that every country in NATO was obligated by treaty to defend Ukraine, which would include the United States, it would include Canada, England, as well as two-thirds of the EU countries and a number of other countries, like Turkey even. So Russia obviously does not want to have another Article 5 country on their border, particularly a large country like Ukraine. Ukraine has 40 million people. It's roughly the same size and population as Iraq. It's not a tiny state like, say, Lithuania or one of those places. That's really, I think, the main driving force behind Russia's insistence on keeping Ukraine out of NATO. Now, of course, the other side of it is it said, well, the Russians are also imperialists. They want to, Putin has said that he regrets the demise of the former Soviet Union, where Russia lost half of its territory, and that Putin, you know, wants to restore the old Russian Empire. All of that is true. All right? That is Putin's vision.
People get accused of, even from a very nuanced take, they get accused of being a Putin apologist. But would you consider Putin to be imperialist, or do you think that's overly intellectually simplistic?
Well, I think he's definitely an imperialist. I mean, his model is the old Russian Empire from the 19th century. Now, he's not a communist. He came up through the KGB and all of that kind of stuff because that's just the system he grew up under. But in terms of his own politics, he's not a Marxist-Leninist. He's an old-school Russian nationalist. To understand Putin's motivations, you have to understand Russian politics as it was in the 19th century. You know, Putin is essentially the modern-day czar of Russia. And the tradition that he identifies with in Russian politics are people like Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, Ivan the Terrible, you know, all of these great figures in Russian history that helped build Russia into the Eurasian Empire that it became. That's what Putin identifies with on a personal level. And he sees his mission as working to revive the old Russian Empire, including reclaiming the territories in which Russia, you know, either used as a buffer zone or certainly exercised political hegemony over or maintained as colonies. I mean, the Soviet Union itself was a collection of 15 countries. It was that's before you include the Warsaw Pact countries. The Soviet Union was 15 different countries. It was dominated by Russia, but it also included Ukraine. It included, you know, Armenia, Georgia, the Baltic states, some of the Central Asian countries. And yes, Putin really would like to have all of that back. He really would like for Russia to have the kind of international power that it had during the Soviet period. So I would say in that regard, Putin is an imperialist. Now, there are people who say, well, that's not really the right definition of imperialism. That imperialism is more about economic extraction and things like that. And it is. But some of these places have valuable resources as well. Some of these former Soviet republics that are now independent nations that became independent nations after the collapse of the Soviet Union, some of those do have petroleum and gas and you know, their potential passageways for pipelines, or they are pipeline passageways. So, yes, of course, Russia wants to regain control over that to the degree that they haven't already and become dominant over that region. You know, Putin wants to restore the Russian Empire. That's how he sees himself. He sees himself as the modern czar. But that doesn't mean that these other issues that we're talking about are not real issues. It doesn't mean that pushing NATO right up to Russia's border is not a provocative act.
That the 2014 or 2015 color revolution, how much of a role did that play? And because the previous president was more pro-Russian, I don't know. I'm not sure if he was democratically elected or not, but there was this color revolution. And I think that's when Zelensky came to power and Victoria Nuland, under the Obama administration, who's now like assistant Secretary of State, she played a tremendous role in that.
Yes. I do think that was pivotal. Because I think the message that sent to Russia, the American involvement in that, was that the Americans were not going to tolerate a neutral Ukraine. Now it could be said, well, the Russians wouldn't either. They want a Russian puppet in Ukraine. Yeah, that's true as well. But it's also true that the Americans have been behind many of these color-coded revolutions, so to speak, throughout Asia. And obviously the Russians have observed that. And the Russians are actually fearful that the Americans are going to try to stir unrest within Russia itself and carry out a color-coded revolution in Russia itself.
And you think that's the motive of the sanctions?
The current sanctions?
Yeah, the sanctions. You think that the motive is actually just to punish Putin, or you think it's actually an attempt at regime change?
Typically, the motivation behind sanctions, you know, the official purpose would be, well, this is punishment for bad international behavior. You know, it's like sending a kid to their room without ice cream or something. But in reality, the purpose of it is to essentially exercise pressure on the civilian, you know, or just the general public of a nation to pressure the people into overthrowing their government. The idea is, the theory behind sanctions is you make life miserable for people, just ordinary citizens in a country. They get angry at their own government for supposedly causing the problems that led to the sanctions, and then they overthrow their own government. Now, it doesn't work that way in real life. The way it works in real life is that, yes, the public, the civilians, whatever, they do suffer the brunt of the sanctions because leaders have the ability to insulate themselves from that. But what happens is that the people often become even more hardline. There are practically no examples I can think of. I can't think of any right offhand where sanctions have actually produced that kind of result.
Yeah, they didn't in Iran. The mullahs are still in power.
Right, or it didn't work in the DPRK. It didn't work in Iraq. I mean, it didn't work in Sudan. It doesn't work in a lot of places.
It didn't work in Cuba, Venezuela.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we could make a long list of places where sanctions have not worked. It could be argued that Russia is more dependent on international trade than some of these other places are. But I think that's part of Putin's strategy. I think Putin is trying to make Russia into a more autarkic country. And I also think that he's trying to create a Eurasian bloc that is in opposition to the West. Like since the SWIFT sanctions have been imposed on Russia, Russia has switched its financial system over to China. Now, there are certainly some serious risks in doing that. Russia is taking an awfully big gamble by doing that.
Do you think it will lead to major geopolitical realignments? Because it has made things worse with China, and it's also alienated allies, including India, and I think even Saudi Arabia. I'm not sure Israel, even Israel seems to be fairly neutral.
Yeah. Well, this is something that's been developing for a while. If you go back and you look at the history of East-West relations since probably the late 90s, early 2000s, you start to see a particular pattern emerging where you see the rise of the BRICS. The BRICS is an acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and I think they may have added Iran to that now as well. I'm not sure yet if they've done that. But the objective behind that was to create an economic relationship between Asian countries that would essentially be an alternative to the kind of neoliberal order that was being promoted by the United States. Like once the Soviet Union fell apart, we entered into this unipolar world where the United States is the world's lone superpower and really becomes the government of the world, so to speak, and is imposing these neoliberal policies on all these different countries, including Russia. In fact, one of the reasons that Putin is actually popular in Russia is because he overcame all that. He reversed a lot of these neoliberal policies that were introduced into Russia during the Yeltsin era, which were not popular with a lot of Russians. For good reason. For one thing, life expectancy fell by about 20 years during the Yeltsin era. Life expectancy in Russia fell from about 76 years to 56 years. So there are reasons why Russians don't remember that time fondly. But over time, though, we've seen a gradual challenge to this kind of unipolar world order, where these Eurasian countries have started to move closer to each other and in various ways, financial, trade, military, whatever. India gets a lot of its armaments from China, from Russia. Russia and China have become closer as far as their financial relationship. Now, all of that is somewhat precarious because those countries don't really like each other. Russia, China, and India really do not like each other. The only thing they agree on is that they hate the Americans and the West worst. That's the only thing they agree on. Gradually the BRICS countries and then their allies have started to become more and more assertive. And this incident with Ukraine has really brought that to the surface. To get to some of your other points, there was a vote taken in the United Nations. There was a resolution condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine. and 141 nations in the United Nations voted to condemn Russia's invasion. And if you look at the map of who they were, it was the entirety of the Western Alliance and then Western client states. That is most of Latin America, much of Africa, certainly the Pacific Rim countries and all of that. If you look at the ones that voted against the resolution, it was only five. It was Russia, Russia, Syria, Eritrea, the DPRK, and Belarus. But then there were about probably close to 50 or 60 other countries that simply abstained, in the sense that they weren't really going to go up against the West per se, but they were not going to condemn Russia. That included India. That included most of the Middle Eastern countries. I'm not sure how Saudi Arabia and Israel voted on that. I think I'd have to look that up. But I know both Saudi Arabia and Israel, who in recent years have been as close to the United States as any countries. I mean, even during the Trump period, the America was moving closer to Israel and the Gulf states than to Europe. Trump was somewhat antagonistic towards Europe, but he was extremely friendly and accommodating.
That seems to be changing. It seems to be solidifying the Western world. And ironically, like, I see Israel, Saudi Arabia being less close to the United States. That's a huge geopolitical breakthrough. But with this antagonism towards Russia, it seems like a really, like, you had, like, the whole, like, Russiagate during Trump, but there's obviously been tension. There was tension during the Bush and Obama era, and that's when the color revolution happened. But mm-hmm. It really took off under Trump. Would you blame the Trumpgate issue, and not just the more like realpolitik of the geopolitics, but would you blame the whole kind of like culture war angle of what Putin symbolizes culturally, rather than the remnants of the Cold War? Like, how much of a role has that played?
Yeah, well, Russiagate, I think, has actually been a big part of this because during the Trump era, you know, the media really hyped the whole Russiagate angle. I mean, it was the central focus of certain sectors of the media for years, particularly the more liberal sectors like the MSNBC, for example. Really hyped that. And that caused a shift in the thinking of a lot of people on the left, well, among liberal and left opinion in the United States. I mean, it used to be, as we know, it was the conservatives, it was the Republicans who were the Russia hawks. Like, as recently as 2012, when Mitt Romney was running for the presidency against Barack Obama, he was the Russia hawk, not Obama. It was Mitt Romney was the Russia hawk. And then when Trump came in and Hillary Clinton started pushing this line that Trump was a Russian puppet, and then the media picked up on that, yeah, I think that had the effect of creating an anti-Russian climate where you had a lot of liberal and left opinion becoming, you know, like, I know Caleb Maupin, who's an American communist and somewhat actually very sympathetic to Russia in his viewpoint. He calls them the left Bergers, you know, because you have these liberals and leftists who now sound like the John Birch Society, the old John Birch Society.
Well, yeah, it's basically like, it's very similar to McCarthyism.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, right, the Russians have infiltrated everything and taken over everything. Yeah, and that's something that really started after, I think there was three things that really caused the Russophobia that we see today, and that is, certainly the incident in Ukraine in 2014, you know, the whole situation that evolved there, I think that helped get it started. And then parallel to that was the fact that Russia is seen as sort of a traditionalist country. Like, there are a lot of conservatives now, you know, more serious conservatives who have a sympathetic view of Russia because they see Russia as a more traditional country. Whereas you have a lot of liberals and leftists who don't like Russia because they see Russia as a place of, you know, where homophobia and religion and traditional gender roles and things like that are still influential, you know. So it's sort of an interesting dichotomy there that's sort of evolved, you know, where you have people from the far right who like Russia for that reason, but people from the left who don't like Russia for that reason. And then I think Russiagate, though, is really what cemented it. So you do see this kind of new Russophobia. But one thing I wanted to go back to, though, is Israel and Saudi Arabia, because this is really important. The countries of the Middle East have different geopolitical interests when it comes to Russia than the West does. Israel and Saudi Arabia have long been trying to, and the UAE as well, have long been trying to work both ends against the middle when it comes to East-West relations, because they're caught right there in the Middle Eastern region. So they don't want to be too pro-Russian. They don't want to alienate the West by being too pro-Russian, but they don't want to alienate Russia or China either. You know, all of those countries in that region, that Middle Eastern region, a lot of them work both angles. You know, they work the East-West angle. So they do have different geopolitical interests, and both of them were very hesitant to join the sanctions against Russia. I don't think they did. I don't think either Israel or Saudi Arabia yet have actually joined the sanctions against Russia.
And even with Israel, like, there's an assumption in some political circles that Israelis and the American neoconservatives have the same framework, but actually Israel seems to have a much more, there's a lot more nuance. Israel seems much more balanced towards Russia than the American neocons.
Yeah, well, the American neocons have moved to the right of the Likud party. If the American neocons were in Israel today, they would be like the extreme. They would be the right of the right of the right. You know, it's but it gets back to the same. You know, what I was talking about before. It kind of gets back to the different geopolitical differences. The American neocons tend to be more America-centric. Israel tends to be more nationalist, you know, Israeli nationalist. There's obviously overlap, but there are differences, and Russia is one. Russia's probably, if there's anything that would cause a split between the Israeli right and the American neocons, it would probably be Russia, because, you know, they do have different views on Russia.
There's talk of fake news and war narratives, like what actually happened, and both sides have their different narratives. This has always been an issue with war, but is there, because of the role of social media today, is there anything unique about the issue of, like, fake news and, like, getting the truth about the war narratives?
No, I don't know that there's any different. I mean, we have more media outlets through which to distribute war propaganda, but I don't know that the content or flavor of it is any different. I mean, let's go back to, say, World War One, when you would see all the inflammatory pieces and all the Hearst-owned newspapers about the barbarian Huns and that kind of stuff. We're seeing the same thing now with Russia. You know, we're seeing people saying they're going to boycott Russian vodka. And I saw today a piece where there's an orchestra in England that's not going to play Tchaikovsky because he was Russian or something like that.
Actually, you saw a news item today that Facebook is going to allow people advocating violence against Russia is going to be removed under the hate speech categorization. It is pretty extreme, the kind of rhetoric. It goes way beyond, because even during the Bush era, George Bush was always trying to say, like, most Muslims are good people, and it's Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and he kind of tried to, like, virtue signal, but it's maybe bordering on the kind of almost like racial animus that we saw when the during World War II of Japan. It's almost bordering on that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. It's kind of like some of the after 9/11, you had a subset of Americans who would do things like go out and attack somebody wearing a turban because they thought they were Muslim, you know, even if they were actually Sikh or Hindu or something like that. We're seeing that kind of stuff. You know, we're seeing this kind of anti-Russian hysteria being pumped up. And, you know, it's interesting how it's coming from the left as much as the right. You know, I saw a meme recently where someone was saying, well, Ukraine is the George Floyd of countries or something like that. So they're trying to link those two things together. Although I do think that's interesting as well, because it seems like liberal and left opinion in the United States is going back to what it was in the pre-Vietnam War era. In the pre-Vietnam War era, with the exception of outright communists who were Soviet sympathizers, and today we have these people we call tankies who will continue to be Russian or Chinese or whatever sympathizers. But the there was actually a great deal of Cold War liberal hawkishness prior to the Vietnam War. In fact, the Vietnam War itself was started by liberal hawks. It was started, you know, it wasn't...
Yeah, so I think it's important to emphasize that, because people are act like there's some new realignment. Are the Democrats' liberal side becoming more hawkish? But that's nothing new.
Right. I mean, it was...
Yeah, even with the Iraq War, like many Democrats, they backed it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, the central thrust of the Democrats has always been the Wilsonian viewpoint. You know, not the kind of far further left pacifist, you know, anti-war McGovernite viewpoint. And that's really become central to the Democrats' approach to foreign policy over time. You know, I guess certainly since the Bill Clinton era, and it's escalated, you know, more and more that way since then. So that kind of Wilsonian framework is really the foundation of the Democrats' orientation towards foreign policy. Interestingly, of anybody in the mainstream media that's criticizing all of this, that's the most outspoken is Tucker Carlson. And Tucker Carlson is, you know, he's really just sort of in the tradition of the older Taft Republicans, you know, who tended to be somewhat more isolationist or non-interventionist or whatever in their international views. So there's really nothing new about him either. Although, you know, a lot of the Republicans, though, have gone out, you know, they're trying to outdo MSNBC in their hawkishness. You know, you have some guy like Lindsey Graham saying he wants to assassinate Putin and stuff like that, you know, as if the Russian state has no plan of succession or something like that. It's like Graham thinks he's dealing with some medieval monarchy or something.
Also, it does seem that even though you have Tucker Carlson, who's taking anti-war skepticism of war position, you do see that the GOP, Trump to a degree, was kind of a pushback against the neocons, but you do see the GOP returning more to a hawkish position. You see that too. And even then, like, you do see a bit among the establishment, a bit of like the bipartisan consensus among like Democrat hawks and GOP hawks, as opposed to the, when Trump was president, it was just a total, it just appeared like a total partisan divide, even if it was purely symbolic. But you do see a return to the GOP hawks. And I do predict that if Trump runs again, or some other Republican like Ron DeSantis, Tom Cotton, or who knows, I think it's not going to be, even, I mean, it's hard to say because the economic crisis could lead to populism, but I could see a scenario where they're running sort of as like Biden is Carter because of inflation and incompetency, and that he's weak, and that we need a new Ronald Reagan. So you could see the GOP run on hawkishness and financial conservatism again.
Well, yeah, I think that's what they're gearing up for. One thing I would point out is that the neocons have largely created a front movement that's called national conservatism. National conservatism is an effort to, at least as I interpret it, is an effort to essentially co-opt Trumpism. It's like they want to bend Trump's movement towards neoconservatism, you know, in a way that bypasses Trump. You know, they want to basically push Trump to the side and steal his movement, and basically use the Trumpian base as the base for this national conservatism phenomena, which is really just a neocon front movement, in my estimation. And that's exactly what they're hoping for. You're exactly right. They're hoping that they can portray Joe Biden as the new Jimmy Carter. And there are parallels between Biden and Carter, but they're hoping they can portray Joe Biden as the new Jimmy Carter, and they're hoping their guy will be the new Ronald Reagan, and that is a president that the neocons and others with similar views can essentially pull the strings of. And they're desperately looking for somebody to be their front man. You know, I think they've got all these guys that they kind of float out from time to time, whether it's DeSantis, whether it's Marco Rubio, whether it's Cruz, whether it's Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley. There's a lot of these guys that they're kind of test marketing to see which one sells. I think they're going to have a hard time with that, finding somebody who is sellable to the majority of the U.S. public on the level necessary to win a presidential election.
Yeah, and then also it does seem that since focusing on Ukraine, there is like an element you are focusing on white people and whiteness, and you have see these like Black Lives Matter figures or the 1619 Project founder who are unhappy. They feel that they're no longer the center of attention, but do you see like woke culture, BLM, Black Lives Matter, no longer being center stage? And you do see, like, I predict if war does accelerate, you could see this kind of, like, new patriotism. Like, I think the establishment will push, like, a convoluted hybrid of, like, Reaganism, but with a kind of, like, more moderate, watered-down version of wokeness. Like, a fusion of, like, Reagan and the civil rights ideology. But I don't think it's gonna... Yeah, I mean, I think that's what they're going to try to push, but I don't think it's going to fly or succeed.
Well, for years, I've been predicting largely what you're describing. There's an article I wrote for the LouRockwell.com website probably in 2000, late 2006, early 2007, so about 15 years ago. And that's exactly the scenario I outlined in that. I said that you had all of these forces bending towards each other. You had this, what we now call woke, it wasn't really called that then, but this politically correct, you know, woke social justice warrior, whatever the
label is. The thing is, it's not like, it's not Howard Zinn, where it's a staunch critique of Americanism. I think even the play Hamilton captures it. It's a hybrid of wokeness and Americanism and even patriotism. It's different than leftism.
Yeah, well, I tell you another analytical framework we can use to understand that, and that's Marxism. The Marxists will argue, I think correctly, that whenever a ruling class is trying to legitimize itself, what they will do is create what they call an ideological superstructure that serves as the dominant ideology in the society and the ideology of the state, and which teaches that the actions of the state are by definition just and the best there is.
So the thing is that's true. So wokeness sort of became that in 2020, but now if there is a major war, then the establishment is going to demand more patriotism, and that's very different than it's not going to be like 2020's CRT ideology. It's going to be some kind of like convoluted hybrid.
Well, yeah, I think so. And we're seeing that develop now. We're seeing that develop among some of, in the left, YouTube spaces. Like there's this guy named Vaush. He goes by the name Vaush.
Oh, yeah.
His real name is Ian something, Ian Koshinsky or something like that. But he is popular among these young left, you know, self-proclaimed socialist, social media fans. And he is all out on the whole anti-Russia thing. Like, he calls himself an anarchist, but then he calls himself an anarcho-NATOist now. You know, it's like there's this whole subculture of left people that are like pro-NATO and anti-Russian, and they see Russia as like the new headquarters of world fascism, and they see the NATO war against Russia as like the Allies' war against the Third Reich during the Second World War. So that's the kind of narrative that's coming out of that subculture.
So they're very different. I want to emphasize they're very different than the element that came out of the Black Lives Matter movement that was explicitly anti-American.
Yeah, I think to a point. You know, like I said, recently I saw a meme of somebody was circulating where it said that Ukraine was the George Floyd of nations. You know, so they are trying to blend the kind of woke, politically correct, you know, social justice, anti-racist, whatever kind of narrative there are people trying to blend that into this kind of pro-American framework. And I've been predicting that was going to happen for years, for decades. I've always thought that the state was going to try to co-opt this kind of farther left, cultural left narrative and try to incorporate that into the state ideology. And they're doing that. They're trying to do that. At the same time, they're approaching it from a right-wing angle as well, sort of in a kind of an odd way. I mentioned the National Conservatives earlier. Back in the fall, back in October, the National Conservatives had a gathering in Florida. It was a big conference. And if you look at what was going on
there. Is Rubio affiliated with that?
Oh, yeah. He was one of the speakers. Rubio, Cruz, and Hawley were speakers there. But if you look at what they're trying to do with national conservatism, they're trying to create this kind of forced together type of rainbow right, you know, like a lot of the prominent speakers, like Peter Thiel is one of the big backers of this project. A lot of the prominent speakers at this were people that are openly gay, like say Douglas Murray or Dave Rubin. You had a prominent black conservative there, Glenn Lowry. You had a very Jewish woman who's known for being a critic of political correctness there. You had it's like they went out of their way to make this as diverse and rainbow and multicultural as possible. But then the common theme of it was, it's sort of a variation of Dinesh D'Souza's whole line about, you know, Democrats are the real racists but then they're trying to give it this kind of traditionalist gloss that kind of.
So your point is that it's the same. That's what's going on with the sort of center left types.
Yeah, exactly. When I saw what was going on at this conference, I discussed it with Paul Gottfried, who's been studying the neocons and a rival of the neocons for years, and we both agreed it looked like some kind of Trotskyite front project or something. It was just so bizarre what they were trying to do. I think that's what's happening. I think on the center left and on the center right, you're seeing this kind of effort to have a kind of mixture of rainbow culture and woke and political correctness that's blended with a pro-American or pro-NATO, at least. For the left, I think they may not want to go so far as to say they're pro-American, they're patriotic. They'll say, well, we're pro-NATO, you know, because that's that's like a federation of nations, you know, that kind of thing. I've been seeing a lot of that on the kind of woke left as well since the Russia thing started.
Yeah, and I think it will fail, but one thing to factor in is economic crisis, because all these issues, there's inflation, there's the wars exacerbating supply chain crises, there's all these issues going on with the Federal Reserve. Who knows what will happen with the economy, but it looks pretty bleak. And just kind of going into the future, like the United States will exist. It's an economic, like, I don't think some of the more conspiratorial side of dissident populist politics predicts more of like centralized techno-totalitarianism. And I think actually a segment of the elites, definitely that's what they're going for, that's what they want, but that's not what's going to happen, what I see happening. I see more like an economic kind of political zone, but very divided along class, but also kind of like tribal sectarianism, or you could say even enclavism, which was what I've been talking about. So that seems to be the trend, not like a centralization of power. But I think that, as you said, like the kind of hybrid of wokeness and patriotism, that's definitely going to backfire.
Well, I agree with everything you just said 100%. Right now, the United States seems to be going in several different directions at once, or at least multiple things are converging. One is that I think that domestically, the United States is becoming more like the European Union in the sense that there's not really a common culture or national identity to the United States anymore. It's, you know, the United States is just a currency zone. You know, we use the dollar. And it's a trade zone. You know, we don't have tariffs between, you know, Virginia and Maryland or something like that. So that's what we're becoming in terms of structural mechanisms. And then at the same time, I think we're becoming more like Latin America in terms of our class system. You know, if we look at the wealth disparities between rich and poor and the middle class and all of that, we see that the United States is certainly becoming more and more like a Latin American country in terms of class relationships. And along with that, you see the kind of open corruption and that kind of stuff that you see in a lot of Latin American countries. And then culturally, I think in many ways we're becoming kind of like the Middle East in the sense that we're fragmenting into all these tribes and sectarian
groups. I've written about something called panenclavism. What would you say is the basis of that idea? You see comparisons to, and do you see that as taking off?
Well, I think it may be an alternative to perpetual social war. I think that the danger we have in the United States is this culture war stuff continuing to escalate and the related tribalism and sectarianism, where we end up like, say, Northern Ireland in the 70s and 80s, where you have people planting car bombs and that kind of stuff. I could very easily see that happening. I don't really see anything happening in the United States that is going to change that or make Americans any less divided. What are Americans going to unite around that they hate Putin? I mean, that's not very, that's a pretty thin thread there. But I do think that over time you will see, in fact, we already see this. I've read some of your material on panenclavism, and I think you're absolutely right in the sense that we already see things like what you've written about happen. There's a social scientist named Bill Bishop. He's based in Austin. But for years, he's been writing about this thing called the Big Sort, where people who have a shared identity, a shared lifestyle, a shared culture, a shared political philosophy are migrating towards each other. And that's how we're getting all these very liberal and very conservative enclaves in the United States today. On one hand, we've got Texas, where they're saying, there's not going to be any abortion after 6 weeks or something like that. And then you've got, on the other end, you've got, the Bay Area, where they're saying, well, we're not going to prosecute misdemeanor crimes anymore or things like that. So those are all fairly extreme viewpoints compared to mainstream opinion, or at least what used to be mainstream opinion. But you do see this. You see people with different viewpoints self-segregating into enclaves at the local level. And you start to see that impacting policy. You see the sanctuary cities where you have some people saying, well, we're not going to enforce federal immigration laws. And then you see Second Amendment sanctuaries where you have people saying, well, we're not going to go buy any gun laws. Or I guess you could say the marijuana, the states that have legalized marijuana, even though it's still illegal at the federal level, I guess you could say they are, marijuana sanctuary cities or states or something like that. And there's a lot of other examples that there are some people saying that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, they're going to have their locality become a pro-choice or pro-abortion sanctuary.
Oh yeah. Or do you see like white Americans, like do you see them clinging on to Americanism, or do you see them starting to act and think more the way like a diaspora would?
I think that's going in different directions. I think that you see older Americans, people who were, say, in their 50s and older, if not older than that, who watch Fox News and get the bulk of their news and politics from, say, Fox News or some similar outlet. I think some of those are still kind of hanging on to the old Reagan paradigm, that kind of conservatism. But I think you see a lot of other people who've given up on that and come to see the United States as kind of like the equivalent of a hostile country. Certainly that's true of people who are very further right.
That kind of explains like why there's like a segment of, I'm not necessarily endorsing this, but a lot of dissidents, I think, are sympathetic to Putin just simply from the friend-enemy distinction of having a common enemy. But the key point is not so much the Putin angle, but that they actually feel like they're a stateless people.
Yeah, I think so. I all throughout the dissident right, there's quite a bit of that. There's a lot of folks who say, hey, Putin is, he represents a traditional society, a religious society, you know, whatever kind of society, a nationalistic society. But what do you see back, you know, back to your pan-enclavist idea, you know, you have a place called Moscow, Idaho now, which is basically, it's people there are creating a colony for conservative Christians. It's almost like the utopian socialist colonies that you saw emerge in the 19th century, you know, like Charles Fourier and that kind of stuff. And you have someone like Rod Dreher, who's a writer for the American Conservative. He's an Orthodox Christian. He argues in favor of what he calls the Benedict Option, which is sort of like a creating a conservative counterculture or something like that.
Parallel institutions.
Yeah, well, the left has long advocated for that kind of stuff, and they still do. I mean, there's still a lot of people on the far further left who, you know, socialist, anarchist, communist, people like that who advocate for that kind of thing as well.
But then you see that with, like, the crackdown on Bitcoin. That relates to, like, trying to prevent alternative institutions from forming, or all these different things like talk of a digital currency.
Yeah, well, I've been predicting that for a while. I know back when the Bitcoin thing started becoming a thing, you had a lot of people into alternative politics really embracing that. And I was always somewhat skeptical of that, because I always said, well, you know, it doesn't mean anything if the...
Because it's basically, I think Bitcoin seems to be tied to the stock market.
Yeah, well, it doesn't mean anything if the state can come and take your computers and put you in jail and stuff like that. You can't trade Bitcoin from prison. I think I've seen an increased repression, I guess you could say, of the Bitcoin milieu as well. I've also seen recently, since January 6th of last year, I've seen more efforts by the state to take down the leadership of far-right organizations. I know they indicted Stuart Rhodes for sedition, the leader of the Oath Keepers. And now I think they've arrested the leader of the Proud Boys for the same thing. So, you know, what we're seeing is very similar, for example, to what was done in the 60s with the Chicago conspiracy trial, when the Justice Department tried to put the leaders of the anti-war movement on trial for sedition as well. We're seeing the right being targeted in that way. And then we're seeing the left being targeted, too. There have been investigations.
So, yeah, like with, censorship seems to be getting worse. Like, because of the war, greater crackdown on more social media censorship, deplatforming, a crackdown on civil liberties, and do you think the left will be targeted as well?
The sectors of the left that they can't use or co-opt will be targeted. And the right as well. The way that the system works is that they try to co-opt, you know, any kind of alternative movements that come along. What they can't co-opt, they try to suppress or destroy, and we see that happening. You know, we see that happening with a number of different tendencies now. But yeah, I mean, anything that's seriously on the left that is genuinely perceived to be a threat to the system, I think there's going to be repression against. Well, we've already seen it with Russia Today now is largely banned in the West. People I know who work for them have now lost their jobs because they shut down their Western divisions.
They took down Oliver Stone's documentary on YouTube about the color revolution.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that's kind of, there's going to be more of that. We can expect that to happen more and more. So that always happens during wartime. I mean, wartime and censorship, you know, go hand in hand. So I think that this is going to last for a while. As far as the war in Ukraine, I don't think this is going to go well for Russia. I think this is going to be Russia's Iraq. You know, I on social media, I've been calling Putin George W. Bush, you know, a synthesis of Vladimir Putin and George W. Bush, because I think that this is really his George W. Bush moment in many ways. Well, it depends on how limited his objectives are. If Putin has more limited objectives, he may get away with this. But if he really tries to occupy and annex Ukraine, I think that this is going to be the Iraq war for Russia. So I don't really see this having a very happy ending for Russia.
Yeah, because like even if you go to these sort of like the narratives about how NATO provoking the conflict, because if the humanitarian crisis gets... It's already terrible, and it probably will, as that escalates, worse... And there's more civilian casualties. That does put Putin in a in a very bad light, and obviously he does deserve blame for that, because there's not an excuse for the invasion, because he had leverage through other diplomatic means, and even like the energy and the energy pipeline. So yeah, as far as a conflict, what do you see as the motive of the Ukrainian government, and do you see this escalating out of control and possibly spreading to other nations even?
Well, I think as far as the motive of the Ukrainian government, I think that they were in the process of trying to get into NATO and into the EU. I do think that that was probably the Zelensky government's goal. And I think that's one of the reasons why Putin made the move when he did. He was afraid that that would actually happen. In fact, since the war started, the Ukraine has actually tried to petition to join the EU. And the reason for that is obvious. The EU has a mutual defense compact between its members. And two-thirds of the members of the EU are also NATO members. So that means if Ukraine were to join the EU, it would be under the umbrella of NATO by default. So that's essentially what Zelensky's trying to do. He's trying to sneak Ukraine under the NATO umbrella by default. And also Georgia is trying to do the same thing, as is Moldova.
As far as like the motive, there's one narrative that it's a rational decision for self-defense and also prosperity. And then some people will just call Zelensky a puppet. And then there's a narrative that Ukraine is rational for wanting to be under some kind of defense network and also the economic benefits from joining the EU. So it is complex.
Well, I think that the latter is true. Whenever I look at these issues, I always look at it like, okay, if I were an advisor to Putin, or if I were president of Ukraine, or if I were an advisor to the U.S. State Department, and my job was to advance the foreign policy interest of any of these places, what would I be doing? And how would I see things? And I think certainly if I were an official in the Ukrainian government, I would look at it like it was in Ukraine's interest to be in NATO and be in the EU, to be under the defensive umbrella of both and under the economic umbrella of the EU. So I do think that that was one of the Zelensky government's goals. I think it's one of the things that motivated Putin to go to war with Ukraine, because I think he looked at it like, well, if let this go too far, they will actually be in the EU, they will be in NATO, and then if we go to war with them then that's going to invoke Article 5. They will be an Article 5 country. So I suspect that that's the reason why Putin made his move when he did, before they had the chance to join NATO. In fact, this is speculation, but I've heard a lot of people from the pro-Trump camp or from the Republican camp say, well, this wouldn't have happened under Trump because, Trump was supposedly more hawkish with Russia, or, even though he was a Russian puppet, as the other side says, or whatever. But I don't think that that's been established at all. If anything, I think the opposite could be true. I think that the Biden administration is far more NATO-friendly than the Trump administration was. And I suspect that it's quite possible that, I mean, this is still speculative, but I suspect it's quite possible that that Putin views the Biden administration as more of a threat to Russia's geopolitical interests than Trump was, although Trump was far more hawkish with Russia than a lot of people recognize. For instance, the Trump administration unilaterally abrogated the INF treaty, but the Biden administration is very pro-NATO. They are a pro-NATO administration. And Biden, is a continuation of the Obama Clinton, tradition, where they're trying to shore up and strengthen NATO. And I see no reason why the Biden administration would object to having Ukraine in NATO. And I think that the Russians quite possibly saw that. They probably quite possibly saw that with people like Victoria Nuland, with people like Antony Blinken and the State Department, they looked at it like this is their chance to either, to make their move before before Ukraine can actually join NATO. I suspect that quite possibly is part of the motivation of Putin, like as why he did this now at this point.
There's this YouTuber, Gonzalo Lira, Coach Red Pill, who's he's an American living in Ukraine, and he's been accusing the Zelensky government of using civilians as human shields by the motive of arming civilians. He's alleging that Zelensky is using him as human shields. Is there any validity to those accusations? Because he says that he's in danger. He claims he's in danger for his life from the Ukrainian militias.
I think that this is correct. That's exactly what the Ukrainians are doing, because the so far it looks like the Ukraine strategy for resisting Russia is basically, you know, overwhelm them with numbers, because that's really what they have. The Ukraine has forbidden any males of military age, or I think really any males, any adult male at all. I think they've forbidden adult males from leaving the country. So essentially they have conscripted the entire male population of the Ukraine. The Ukraine is handing out weapons to virtually everybody in the general public. I mean, probably women and maybe even kids too. They're just basically handing out weapons to anybody. And then they're activating all of these civilian militias and things like that. So yeah, I mean, it's clear that Ukraine's defense strategy is this: we're going to overwhelm them with human numbers. Now, obviously, a problem with that. In fact, I heard an interview recently with Chris Hedges, who's a veteran war reporter. He's on the left, but he's a veteran war reporter writing about this. But he was saying that when you would pursue a strategy like this, you are going to get a lot of civilians killed. You know, when your goal is to have a mass popular army of civilian fighters waging guerrilla warfare, you will get a lot of people killed, because that kind of warfare is just very bloody. And then when the army that you're attacking, they start to see the civilian population as the enemy as well, and they become less and less inhibited about civilian casualties and that kind of stuff. In fact, from some of the military actions I've seen Russia do so far, it looks like they're trying to drive civilians out of the occupied territories, the territories that Russia has seized so far. And I think for this reason, I think they don't want to face a popular civilian resistance. They also don't want to have to worry about losing the propaganda wars as far as civilian casualties. But yeah, that happens in this kind of warfare, and that's exactly what the Ukrainians are doing. They've essentially turned the country into a mass army, and their strategy is a mass guerrilla resistance.
Well, argument is that Zelensky intentionally wants the PR from, because if the media shows dead civilians, then there'll be more support for military intervention. That's Gonzalo Lira's argument.
Well, that's entirely plausible. I mean, that would certainly be to the Ukraine government's advantage from a propaganda angle. That doesn't mean they would try to do it that way, but that's entirely plausible. We're already seeing that. I mean, we're already seeing all these reports in the media: oh, the Russians are attacking hospitals, the Russians killed children, whatever. And they probably did. But yeah, I mean, those kinds of things do serve the Ukraine's interest as far as soliciting intervention from other states.
What do you see as the likelihood of the U.S. or NATO getting involved into direct conflict with Russia?
Well, I think the way it's going to start is, the main danger, of course, is the war spreading beyond Ukraine. If it doesn't spread beyond Ukraine, it's just another war. There are dozens of them going on around the world now. But if it spreads outside of Ukraine to Article 5 countries...
So you think more so the Article 5 countries in Eastern Europe, but you don't see it spreading to the Caucasus or the Middle East?
It could. I think the main danger, the immediate danger, is if it spreads into the Baltic states or Poland or Romania or one of those, because already you have the Poles and some of the other NATO countries that are the closest to Ukraine. They're already aiding Ukraine by stealth. I know Poland is giving planes to Poland. If Russia interprets that as an act of war, which they probably do, they could at some point attack one of those countries. They could bomb Poland or something like that at some point. If that were to happen, yes, that would be an Article 5 situation, where the that, you know, a NATO member has been attacked. Now, I think the way that the West is going to try to handle this initially is they're going to do it more the way that they did with Afghanistan when the Soviets were involved in Afghanistan in the 80s. I think they're going to try to build up the guerrilla resistance in Ukraine to Russia through direct aid, but not an outright military intervention. You know, like the Ukrainian militias and all that are going to become the new Mujahideen, essentially. I think that seems to be the Western strategy so far. You know, create a new Mujahideen in Ukraine. But you know, as I said, if they're using NATO countries as a base for this, you know, where you know, for either as supply lines, a base, or a place to launch flights or anything like that, the Russians could end up attacking an Article 5 country. Now, they may be banking, the West may be banking on the Russians not doing that. They may think, no, the Russians aren't going to cross the line to attack a NATO country and put themselves in direct confrontation with NATO. You know, I wouldn't count on that. You know, I don't really know how far the Russians are planning to take this. But yeah, I think that's the real danger. The real danger is that is the war spreading to NATO countries, and if it happens, that's likely how it would happen.
And do you think the supply chain issues, such as like the wheat shortages, because that's basically what's contributed to sparking the Arab Spring, do you think that could have a ripple effect?
Yeah, whenever food costs go up, it tends to create civil unrest. You know, right now in the United States, we're seeing, you know, record inflation as far as, well, record prices for fuel. We're seeing food costs go up, you know, and if this gets worse and continues, yeah, I think we could see civil unrest in a lot of places over this. As far as what form it would take and all of that, but it's absolutely correct. If high food cost is what initially got the Arab Spring started, and you know, and that kind of thing does breed a lot of discontent.
Do you see signs of a major economic collapse? Because the pandemic, obviously, that had a tremendous impact on the economy, but then for a while, things seemed like there was somewhat of a recovery.
I was actually discussing that earlier today with an economist who has this theory that we're headed for an economic collapse, kind of like the dot-com bust back in the late 90s.
The people predicting it the most, it does seem to be the more libertarian financial types like Peter Schiff.
Yeah. A problem with that circle is that they often tend to overstate their case.
And do you think a lot of those, do you think a lot of the financial YouTubers, do you think they go, like, a lot of it is, like, clickbait?
Yeah. Well, in some cases, yeah. I mean, I've seen some of those people for years saying, well, within 2 years, we're going to have massive food riots and that kind of stuff. You know, it's just basically paranoia porn. You know, it's a somewhat more sophisticated version of something like Alex Jones or something like that. But yeah, I mean, the inflation we're experiencing is real. Fuel costs, food costs, the sanctions against Russia, the wartime conditions, the lingering impact of the pandemic, you know, the economic problems that were pre-existing anyway, all of those things are converging, and they're creating some serious economic problems. So, yeah, I mean, I can't imagine there's not going to be some fallout from that.
This will probably be dated by the time I post this, but Keith Preston, thanks for being on, and check out attackthesystem.com.
All right, thank you.